Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. I am Mark Levine. I am here with
Garland Nixon.
I always like making them talk at once. Terry DeKester and Garland Nixon. Y'all need to decide who gets to go first each week. We are the Raucous Caucus. This is 1480 AM. This is We Act Radio. We three are discussing the most important issues of the day, because someone's got to. And there are two very, very important things that just happened this week. One happened on Thursday. Filibusters have probably been changed forever. We'll talk about that, specifically what happened on Thursday and how that could really affect the future as well in the Senate. And then last night, in the middle of the night, did you miss it? It's rare that President Obama gives a speech or a talk or a few words at 10:30 p.m. on a Saturday night. That's highly rare, but a rare thing happened. An interim agreement, as they call it, between the United States and Iran that may actually stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. So big controversial topics, juicy stuff. Let's start with, what should we start with? You two vote.
Either. Both are so important.
They're both important. All right. So we'll talk about the Senate. We'll do the Senate for the first half hour, and we'll do Iran for the second half hour, and also give listeners a chance to call in 202-889-9797. So last Thursday, the Senate did something that, I think it is extraordinary. So we got to talk about the run-up to it. There's a lot of history here. Maybe not give it all up the upfront, but many people know what the filibuster is. That was basically a way back when, where senators could keep talking and keep a vote from actually happening. It was a way for a minority to stop the majority from passing legislation. Probably most famously in that movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, it's sort of seen as a very honorable thing, one senator talking all night long to prevent some bad bill from going through. Basically, it happened as a historic accident. This is something that, actually was the Senate was just going to cut off debate like the House, but they decided in 1806 that wasn't really necessary because there were only like 25, 30 senators and everyone should have a chance to speak. And then that little loophole became rife with abuse. Maybe, Terry, you should take the history from there.
Well, yeah, for the first 118 years, there were no limits on debate in the Senate. And, in 1917, sorry about that, guys, it's early morning here.
Mm-hmm.
In 1917, they cut it off debate on reaching closure. It required two-thirds of a majority
right.
to cut it off the debates at that point. And in 1975, they thought that was excessive, so they reduced it down to 60 out of 100 votes. And even that lower minimum required lawmakers to cooperate with each other. Now the majority can just close it completely. And as one pundit, Dana Milbank, has put it, many others have said the same thing, they've now turned the Senate into the House.
Well, let me just be clear about a couple things, because the filibuster isn't quite dead yet. This may right. very well be the first nail in its coffin, and I don't dispute that. And it, but the play is not over yet. The fat lady has not sung. Use whatever bad metaphor you want to use. All that happened so far, although it could go farther, is when the Republicans said, not that they disagreed with President Obama's specific judicial picks. And by the way, I support the right of filibustering specific judicial nominees that are considered very extreme. I understand it's a lifetime appointment. I supported the Democrats 8 years ago when they said that there were three racist people that President Bush wanted to put on the court, and they were only filibustering those three judges, not all of his picks. I thought that was actually proper. I actually still think that would be proper, but the Republicans took it one step further with respect to the D.C. Court of Appeals, the often called the second most important court in the nation after the United States Supreme Court. They said that President Obama should not be allowed to appoint anybody. The court has a Republican majority, and even though the American people elected the President of the United States, partly so that he could pick judges, they said, you know what, Obama, Article 3 of the Constitution is meaningless to you. We won't allow you to pick any judges on that court. And that was such an extreme thing that Reid responded with probably the only thing he could do, which was the so-called nuclear option, to change the rules in the Senate by a majority rule rather than a two-thirds rule, to say, at least for now, that all presidential appointments will get an up or down vote except the Supreme Court. Thus far, legislation still requires 60 votes to overturn a filibuster, and Supreme Court nominee still requires 60 votes thus far. But I don't dispute that this precedent could be set whereby the Republicans, when they're in charge, could wipe out the filibuster altogether. That's all the facts. Go ahead.
Well, just my opinion on this briefly. I think it was inevitable. You know, desperate times call for desperate measures. When it gets to the point that the minority no longer uses the filibuster to make their point and to stop things that they see as extreme, when they decide that they're going to use it to rule as to basically assume a 41-seat majority, then, you know, it was inevitable. When it gets to the point where, for the first time in history, a Republican, Mitch McConnell, introduces a bill, the Democrats say, fine, we'll vote on it, and he filibusters his own bill.
Right.
I think it was at a point now where there was no option for the Democrats. It was either acquiesce completely to the Republicans and say, we're going to allow you majority rule in the House and minority rule in the Senate, or take this, and I think the nuclear option is bad because it sounds like it's something giant, like it's so big and it's so overwhelming and all-encompassing, when it's not as big as they make it to be. But the fact of the matter is, the only reason it's important is because the Republicans took this to such an extreme, there weren't a lot of options left for the Democrats other than to cede power to the Republicans, even though they have the majority.
Well, I agree with your first point. I mean, in some way, you know, reaction, though, is always less than action. And I mean, that's the real problem. I mean, you know, the Republicans have been reactive to everything, and then the Democrats now are just reactive to what the Republicans are reactive to. And this is not constructive. The real question here is, how is the Senate going to function in the future, and how is it going to function between whatever, you know, between the individuals? And that's what it really comes down to. There is so much bitterness now. I mean, you can say, yes, the Senate was broken. The Republicans are out of control with all that they're doing. But this does not solve the basic problems that are within the Senate. And I don't know exactly what, even if they'd maybe just reduce it to 57 votes instead of the simple majority, some kind of little lesser action. This action is big enough that it's going to create so much animosity and so much anger that there won't be any real progress. Yes, we may be able to get a lot of Obama's appointees, you know, confirmed and put into office, which would be good. There's something like 240 waiting to be confirmed, and just in the last few years, they've filibustered more of these appointees than ever in the history of the country.
Combined,
which is astounding.
From George Washington to George W. Bush, less filibusters than under President Obama in just 5 years.
Yeah, but at this point, you know, to go this extreme and to cut it off, I mean, you really have kicked the Republicans in the balls. That may sound fun. That may sound like a nice idea. But it's not a good idea because it's really going to create less cooperation.
Yeah, the irony about all of this is that.
Which I think, let me just say this.
Go ahead.
I think it's impossible for there to be less cooperation.
No, that's not true. You're talking about numbers and you're talking about individual people. And, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats have come together on immigration bill, et cetera, et cetera. They have done things. They prevented the financial crash or the governmental crash. You know, they have come together. Maybe it's ugly and sloppy and stupid and, you know, games of chicken, but it has happened. Now there's much less chance of that happening. And when the Republicans get power, and they will get power someday, if not 2014, but they will get it, then it's going to get even uglier.
There was an initial proposal. By the way, most of this has been done by what they call the new guard of the Democratic Senate. A lot of the Democratic senators that have been there for a very long time, one thinks of the lions of the Senate, people like Ted Kennedy or Robert Byrd, have died. A number of very long-serving senators, Chris Dodd, Joe Lieberman, have retired. And so half of the Democrats in the Senate have never been in the minority. And there's one old guard person left, and that was Senator Levin of Illinois, and he's the only liberal that voted against the nuclear option. There were two conservatives, and that's understandable why they did. They, Mark Pryor and Mary Landrieu from Arkansas and Louisiana. These are red states. One can understand why they're voting with Republicans on this. Levin's a true liberal. I mean, no one can question his progressive sentiment, but he has been there a long time. He's 79 years old. He's retiring next year. He's got nowhere to go. And his fear is that the Republicans will take power and end the filibuster altogether, which may not be the most terrible thing. One of the things that interests me, though, is for the Democrats, remember, there's two things the Senate does. One is to confirm presidential nominees. The other is to vote with the House to make legislation.
And treaties.
Oh, right. It also does treaties. But treaties require a two-thirds vote, and therefore it really wasn't affected by the filibuster at all. So that's therefore it's not a filibuster question with treaties. So the Senate does these two things. In terms of passing legislation, the Senate is already stymied by the House, which is controlled by the Republicans. No legislation can pass unless it's bipartisan, period. At least as long as Republicans control the House. Now, if the Democrats get lucky enough, and I think that's an uphill battle, to get take back the House in 2014, then we might want to consider whether or not to get rid of the filibuster for legislation as well. But at the moment, it actually wouldn't help the Democrats at all to take away that part of the filibuster, and I think they knew that, and I think that's what they did. But if it were to go away for legislation, for example, we'd have universal health care. Because that would have passed, at least in 2009 and 2010, that we would have had Medicare for all. That had a good 55 to 57 senator majority, easily. The public option had 55 to 57 senators. One of the reasons we got some of the compromises in Obamacare that many of us on the left don't like is because they had to get that last number of 60 votes. So let me ask you both the question. All right, so this will get a lot of nominations through. Do you both think it will happen, and is it a good idea to end the 60-vote requirement for all legislation and not just for nominations?
Good God, no.
You want to keep the filibuster?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with the senator from Oregon that, you know, they should, in fact, be required to actually stand there and do it.
Right, I agree with that.
Yes, I agree.
We all agree on that.
That puts it in the public eye, so
right.
It becomes, you know, more apparent. But what we're destroying here, you know, and if we go further with this, I mean, again, whatever majority, it can be a majority by one lousy senator, and you're doing two things. One, extreme measures can be passed much more quickly. Secondly, you're really castrating the minority leader, and that's the other problem. You're putting them in the same position that the majority leader, or that what's-his-name in the House is in, as majority leader.
Speaker of the House.
Yeah, he cannot,
John Boehner.
He cannot compromise because of that simple majority rules thing. I mean, he's put in this terrible position. Whereas the majority leader of the Senate, and this is quoting Levin, is expected to try to work out some kind of a bipartisan deal to get enough votes to get closure, because the House is run by majority view, it's seen as a sign of weakness. If the majority leadership of the House has to get votes from the minority side, now that same situation is going to apply to the Senate.
How about you, Garland? Should 60 votes go away for ordinary legislation?
Well, here's my thought on this immediately, and that is looking at the new Republican Party that we have now, which is far to the right of the Republican Party even 7 or 8, 9 years ago. You know, this is my opinion. I have no doubt if the Republicans take party, they'll do away. If the Republicans were to win the House, I mean, excuse me, were to take the Senate and the presidency, they'd do away with all of it. The Republican Party we have now today doesn't play those games anymore. These people, the Ted Cruz's and Mike Lee's, these people are not into allowing things to go through. They are so they so strongly believe that they have the moral high ground. There's no doubt in my mind they'd wipe out every filibuster, any options, everything. It would be scorched earth. So I think the fact of the matter is, regardless of what the Democrats do or don't do, if the Republicans get it, they're not playing these kind of games.
Which means that the filibuster is dead anyway. That basically what Reid set in motion today will mean eventually the end of the filibuster for everything.
I don't think it mattered if Reid set it in motion. These Ted Cruz's and Mike Lee's and these people, if they get power, it doesn't matter what the Democrats do. It doesn't matter how, if they play footsie with them, if they kiss their behind and shine their shoes. If they get power, they're not playing these kind of games. They're not pussyfooting around. It's scorched earth.
Except that, Garland, let's remember that the Senate, even to do a nuclear option to end the filibuster, would require a majority vote, And even if the Republicans took back the Senate, that doesn't mean a majority of the Senate would be Tea Party Republicans. I mean, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, I agree with you about those people. But there are still moderate Republicans in the Senate. I mean, you know, John McCain, and I'm no huge fan of John McCain, but someone who's respecting the institutional prerogatives of the Senate, he might not go that far, but now hasn't Reid opened the door to that in the future. Who wants to take that?
And, you know, this is the big danger. I mean, the Republicans are going to gain power at some point. I mean, you just simply can't deny that. It's, you know, it's just naive to think that they won't. And this is made, you know, this is sort of like, you know, putting up the Berlin Wall, you know, from one side and then finding out later, oh, the bad guys are going to use it too. You know, I mean, it really makes no sense. It's self-destructive. You know, I understand what Garland is saying, and I agree with him, but the point is, and this point has been made a lot, there used to be at least some kind of, you know, some kind of little bit of civility between various senators. There used to be a lot of social interaction. That social interaction has shrunk. That civility has shrunk. One of the ways that the social action and civility still does work is actually in the Senate dining room. They do actually, at least up until recently, they do actually sit down at the same table and talk. You know, now you've really put a big block to everything that was possible. It's,
you know, what I find
worse, not better.
What I find fascinating is during the government shutdown, there were two people who were definitely at each other's throats, Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid, the minority and majority leader of the Senate. But even though John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi may be at each other's throats, John Boehner can just ignore Nancy Pelosi. He can just swat her away. I love Nancy Pelosi. I think she was a great Speaker of the House. But because the system meant that Boehner could ignore her, he did. And Nancy Pelosi played no role in any of the government shutdown. Mitch McConnell played a role. And largely it was because of the Senate being able to come to some agreement, some bipartisan agreement, they were able to force the end of the government shutdown down the throat of the House. Let me suggest to you a proposal that I really liked that came up, and I think it was your Senator Jeff Merkley, who, by the way, has been in the forefront of ending the filibuster, the senator from Oregon, one of the new young guns, probably the single most important person in getting rid of the filibuster. He had a proposal that I really liked early on that nobody jumped onto, and that was that the first vote on a proposal requires 60 votes. The second vote would require 58. You have to wait. Then you had to wait about 2 months. Then you could do it with only 58. Then you waited 2 months. Then you could do it with 56. Then you waited 2 months. Then you could do 54 and then wait 2 months. Then 52, waited 2 months, and then finally a majority. So that, in other words, if there's determined opposition and yet there was a determined majority, eventually you could pass something. It would. It might take 10 months. It might take a year, but eventually you could pass something. But the idea was to keep the idea. It is a really bad thing where the minority could speak and raise questions, but eventually the majority would rule. I actually really liked that idea as a way to keep the idea of the filibuster alive, but not let it absolutely stifle things. No one took that compromise. I don't know what either of you think about it.
Well, it's also, you add this to the idea that, you know, the pork has basically been eliminated. The leaders now of the House and the Senate, you know, are just becoming more and more leaderless. I mean, they just simply can't negotiate and don't have the power they used to have. Yes, that power was misused. Yes, LBJ misused it. But it was a way of sort of keeping some kind of action and control in both the House and the Senate. Now we're moving towards there's no control of the House, which, you know, poor Boehner proves constantly, and there's not going to be no control of the Senate either. And, you know, sooner or later you're going to get a majority that's really ugly, like Garland is worried about, and that majority is going to just push the minority out the door.
And yet. As much as I see the future, it's fraught. I see where you're coming from, Derry. I gotta say, on balance, if it were up to me, I would have voted with the rest of the Democrats, because I think that they pushed us to this, and I don't know where else they could have gone other than what they did.
How do you recover from it?
Go ahead, Garland.
I think that what we're seeing now, rather than, you know, it is what it is. It's happened. And I think if you try to interpret, well, what is this? What's going on here? What does this mean? I think it's a reflection of where today's politics are. I think it's reflective of the fact that we have a party, the Democratic Party, that where there is some level of unity, and we have
more so than ever before. By the way, I should know. We used to be. Right. Will Rogers used to say that I'm not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat.
Right.
So we've come a long way.
On the other side,
Go ahead, Garland.
Side, we have a group of warring factions, which we call a party, but it's not a party, but we have a group of warring factions that is currently being dragged around by the most absurd, unreasonable, extreme faction of the party. So what we have is a very dysfunctional system, and it's not dysfunctional because of the Democratic Party. They are pretty much what they've always been. The Republican Party has collapsed. I firmly believe it has collapsed, and from between now and 2014, greater, much more evidence will be there that the party has collapsed. So I think that's what we're looking at. The Senate and the House right now, our country is ungovernable because we got one party and a group of warring factions that don't make up another party. And that's all we're seeing. You're just not going to have normal functional politics right now because one of the parties has completely collapsed.
Terry, did Reid have any other choice than to do what he did?
Yeah, I mean, this has probably strengthened the Republican Party, though, Garland, and I think that's what will happen. Well, this will be a big issue in the campaign.
No, see, I don't think middle America cares about the filibuster. In Washington, we're all in the Beltway. Garland and I live within the Beltway. You used to, Terry. I think we really care about it here, and I think we understand it, and we know how it works, and we understand this was a real big deal. I would bet you that 80% of America couldn't tell you what a filibuster is, and 90% couldn't tell you what happened last Thursday.
Sure they can, because they all have that image of Mr. Smith.
No, they don't. They've never heard of Mr. Smith, Terry.
No, yes, they have. As ridiculous as that image is, it still exists. That filibuster is used by heroes. And all you need is Democrats or Republicans to stand up and say, look what they've done to the men who have saved this country through filibuster. And they're going to say it, and they're going to say it just like they say everything else and distort it. And the Republicans go, oh, geez, the Democrats are trying to take over the government again. They're trying to turn us into a socialist state, yada, yada, yada.
I wonder if Reid had, instead of imposing a nuclear option to get those three judges through, had put back the speaking filibuster and required the Republicans to go all night and all day and stop everything in the tradition of Mr. Smith goes to Washington if he wouldn't have achieved the same deal. Now, don't get me wrong. It would shut down the Senate for months on end and make the public really angry at Republicans. But what's so wrong with that? What do you think about that, Garland? Should that have been the route he used?
I'm 100%, and that as soon as that happened, well, excuse me, Mark, you know, the three of us have actually discussed this over the past couple years, and
we've
all said, why in the world won't they do that? That's what they should have done, and the Republicans would have, with all the filibusters, what they would have had to do, the Senate would have had to filibuster 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, day in and day out, month in, month out, and they couldn't have kept that up.
Yeah, I mean, don't go home for Christmas. They said, don't go home for Christmas. Don't go home for Thanksgiving. As Thanksgiving comes, Reid could have a standing order that says the moment they stop talking, then the vote. I mean, if they had to do a nuclear option, have a nuclear option that says that the moment they stop talking, it will be a automatic. All these judges get heard, every single one of them. Now, maybe Ted Cruz, and he would have been a hero among some, would have given up his Thanksgiving dinner, you know, and he and Mike Lee would have tag team sitting in the Senate, you know, one of them eating turkey while the other one talks, and then switching. And maybe the Tea Party would have considered them heroes, but it would have certainly ratcheted it up, and people would have noticed. I don't think most people noticed last Thursday. I really don't.
The most important thing about democracy, and I'm not even sure democracy can possibly work anymore, what we call democracy anyway. The most important thing about it, really, even if I don't like it, is that it's so damn difficult to pass any legislation. That's really the foundation, and it's really, really hard to make change. And therefore, a majority can't get in and just make change in one swell swoop, and suddenly you've got Nazi Germany. You just can't do that. Now it's easier for the majority to do whatever it wants, and that in a democracy is not good.
But we do have lots of checks and balances. I mean, let's be fair. We do have a constitution that protects all kinds of rights. We do have a judicial branch. One of the reasons why this particular change, I think, something had to be done was because the judicial branch is a third very powerful branch. Right to appoint judges is one of those basic sacrosanct constitutional principles that Republicans were denying. Something had to be done on this point.
Something had to be done. No question about that.
But to say we're going to slide into Nazi Germany if the majority rules, I think discounts all the other checks and balances we had in the American system. Let's all remember the filibuster ain't in the Constitution. It came up as a historical accident. Go ahead, Gron.
And the thing about it is, I mean, at some point the Democrats had to make a decision. When you have a party that claims minority rule and simply says it doesn't matter, when they say no, we're not filibustering. We're not stopping judges because we think anything's wrong with a judge. We're stopping judges because ideologically we control that. People of our ideology controls that particular bench, and we're going to keep it that way. They are now governing with the filibuster. They're using the filibuster to govern, which means they have assumed power. I just don't think you can allow that to happen. Once they do that, if you don't stop them at that point, if you don't step up to them and say, because this is not new. In fact, I believe it was a couple months ago when the Democrats threatened to end the filibuster because they were trying to govern through the use of the filibuster, and they came up with a deal to let somebody through. And the Republicans said, well, you know what? We've decided we're not going to stop that. We're just going to run this country through the using the filibuster. You know what? The Democrats, I didn't see another option other than just for Harry Reid to just walk over to Mitch McConnell and say, here's the gavel. You take the Senate. You're running it anyway. There's nothing I can do.
No, we had the option. We've already said that, and we agreed upon it. All they had to do was make it public. Get the filibuster out there on the floor. Let them stand there and filibuster for 2.5 years if they want to. Make it public, because that does get reaction from the society. That does get reaction from the voters. They do pay attention when it gets to that level of drama. And that's what, in fact, allows the filibuster to go a certain point, but not to go all the way.
Here's the other thing I think Reid could have done, is that if he required the speaking filibuster, and again, you'd have to reimpose that by nuclear option, but okay, use the nuclear option to reimpose the speaking filibuster. Then, if the Republicans go all Thanksgiving, talking and stopping everything, and if they go all through Christmas, stopping everything. We let it happen for 6 weeks. We let it happen through the holidays, which is the perfect time to let it happen. And they make a huge deal, and the country's really angry, and congressional approval drops from 9% to 1%, and the Republican Party drops from, you know, from 25% to 12%. Then come January, if they're still talking, then I think if Reid had done this nuclear option 52-48 to get these judges in, people would have heaved a sigh of relief, and everyone would understand it was something he had to do. I think he should have, you know, we're going to get to this with Iran. But I think that when you're facing a determined, implacable enemy, that it's very important how people perceive you, and they may not realize it's a determined, implacable enemy. So what you do is you draw it all the way out. You give every last bit until you're absolutely certain that they're not caving. If he'd done the speaking filibuster for 2 months through the holidays, you're persuading me, Terry, after January, then if they kept it going and the whole government wasn't working, then he could say the Senate's dysfunctional, boom, there goes the filibuster. And I think even Republicans, and certainly independents, would cheer him. Garland, in hindsight, wasn't that the best way to do this?
Well, and add this, Mark, there's something else even more important. And when January comes, they have to do a continuing resolution or pass the budget.
That's true.
They have to do the debt ceiling. So when January came, the Republicans would have to make a decision. They would have to either continue to filibuster and close the government down again.
Right.
Because exactly. They'd be filibustering, or they'd have to stop filibustering and come up with a budget or continuing resolution. That would have forced their hand right there.
So I found an agreement among the three of us, and Harry Reid should have listened to us. I mean, now it's too late, but there was a way. All of us believe this obstructionism had to stop. All of us believe the filibuster had to change. But the way you act we would have gotten to the same result. It would have taken 2 more months. We would have gotten to the exact same result in January. But the difference is, in the meantime, politically, Republicans would have looked really, really foolish and obstructionist, which they are, but they keep it hidden. And at the same time, the whole world would know, and the whole country would understand why the filibuster was ending, and it wouldn't be seen as a naked partisan play. And all he had to do was wait 2 months. I think we all three agree that was the best way to do it.
Yeah, and one other little fact. I mean, you know, we sort of look at things in a very narrow view. Just because somebody is filibustering, that is not all that's going on in Congress. There would be, during any filibuster, you know, there would be Democrats and Republicans talking. There would be amendments proposed. There would be compromise proposed behind the scenes. Most of the action is behind the scenes anyway. It's not out in the public.
Right.
And, you know, that would have been going on with a filibuster, so that a compromise probably could have been met pretty easily, even after, if that filibuster was actually on the floor and public, the rest of the action would continue. And it's a much more positive environment.
Well, obviously, Harry Reid should have taken advice from the Raucous Caucus before he made the decision he did, and that was a mistake. And I think at the end of the day, it may just mean the end of the filibuster for once and for all. I'm not so sure that's a terrible thing, but I do think the way that we propose would have been a better option. When we come back, I want to talk about the deal with Iran. I actually see what we're doing with Iran similar to our filibuster proposal, and I'll tell you why when we get back. If you want to call in, it's 202-889-9797. Mark Levine, Terry DeKester, Garland Nixon. We'll be right back with the Raucous Caucus right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with...
Say it, Garland.
Terry DeKester, how's that?
There you go. That seems fair. We are the Raucous Caucus. Our two topics today were the filibuster and the Iranian deal, going from the nuclear option to nuclear weapons. And actually, as far apart as these two subjects might seem, as completely opposite other than the word nuclear as they might seem, I actually see a parallel. I want to run this metaphor by you gentlemen here. I believe, to me, in my metaphor, the Iranian government is like the Republicans. I don't trust them. I think they're dangerous. I think they're out to obstruct, in the Republicans' case, the government in Iran to support terrorism and kill people and so forth. But I actually think the best way to approach the Iranians with the world watching is basically how we just argue we should have approached the Republicans with the country watching. And that is to basically say, look, we don't trust you. But we're going to give you a chance. We're going to give you a chance to do the right thing. And we're going to make it very, very clear that you are the obstructionist before we blow up something. And at the end of the day, if you don't keep the deal, if you keep building nuclear weapons, sure, we're going to do our own sort of nuclear option, not nuke Iran, but basically to take out Iran's nuclear weapons. However, if you back down, if you are as peaceful as you say you are, we're going to give you a chance to show the world. I actually was kind of pleased with the interim deal. I think it has some significant things that will help. One of the things is that Iran's going to get rid of its 20% enriched uranium. You need 90% for a bomb, but the numbers are a little easy to misunderstand, because to go from 3.5 to 20 takes much longer than to go from 20 to 90. So the numbers don't act like, you know, it's very easy to go from 20 to 90. It's not as easy to go from 3.5 to 20. They're going to get rid of that. Most importantly, we're going to have verifiable monitors in all of these Iranian nuclear places. And this is an interim deal. It's 6 months, and I like the fact that it's only 6 months. It means that we get to watch them and find out in 6 months if they are going to keep enriching. And I'll tell you something I also like. I like the fact that the Congress is wondering about it and probably going to pass a kind of a sort of Damocles sanctions that'll appear in 6 months. I like it that Saudi Arabia and Israel are watching us. To me, this is a good cop, bad cop arrangement that might just bring Iran off the brink of nuclear weapons. What say you, gentlemen?
Well, Garland, go first. I feel courteous.
Go ahead, Garland.
Well, there are a couple things, because there are some very basic premises that I have that are different. Number one, I want peace. I don't want war. Number one, those who say, well, if the Iranians don't do this, we should attack them, we should bomb them, we should do this, or anybody should attack them or bomb them, or some kind of preemptive strike. I unequivocally oppose any preemptive military strikes. So there's some basic, you know, kind of a basic foundation there. And I don't fear Iran. I don't see them as some irrational actor. I'm not thrilled with them having nuclear weapons, but I don't see Iran as an irrational actor that would say, well, as soon as we get one, we're going to heave it immediately at Israel and have them throw 50 back at us. I think that's pretty absurd. But there are those who believe that. So I, needless to say, I take a different tack because I have a different foundational belief about the entire issue than many. But here's what I think. I am glad to see anything that moves us in the direction of peace and away from the direction of military confrontation, because nothing ever good comes of military confrontation. And the only thing that's going to happen is a whole lot of innocent people are going to die. And I don't want to see that happen. I'm sick and tired of innocent people dying because of a bunch of idiots at the top can't get their act together.
Boy, Garland and I are in total agreement on that. I mean, I agree absolutely, completely. I am very pleased to see this. I mean, yes, it has its flaws. It has its limitations. You can point those out forever. But it's not. I don't think it's comparable to what we've been talking about in the Congress. I think it's the exact opposite, because here's where six major countries, you know, sat with a whole lot of different points of view and different needs and different requirements and everything else, really sat down together for the first time in a long time and came up with an agreement that does, for the moment, for 6 months anyway, allow us and them to act honorably and peacefully as opposed to any kind of stupid military action. Besides, even if they had not achieved this, the very little least that would be happening in the Middle East, whether Iran got nuclear weapons or not, or if they did get a nuclear weapon, is you would begin another arms race like crazy. The arms race is not limited to just the United States. And
Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt would all develop nuclear weapons if Iran developed nuclear weapons. At least.
Yeah, and it'd be like Pakistan and
India.
India. I mean, they're basically in a small scale, not that small, actually, nuclear arms race. Israel would start increasing its nuclear weapons, you know, then Saudi Arabia would go, well, boy, we got to do it. And it would just cascade very quickly. It may be one place where the domino act is valid, or domino idea is valid.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm very grateful to see this. I think Obama has done an extraordinary job with diplomacy. And I really, really admire him for that. And he's one of the few presidents we've had that would have the skill or the foresight to do that.
And I think the answer is we don't know what's going to happen. I think 6 months from now, we'll all reassess and find out what's going on. I think this temporary pause, if it is affected, and we got to see if the Iranians actually keep their end of the bargain. But if so, could be very useful. And listen, let me say one thing about to make absolutely clear the distinction between the Iranian people and the Iranian government. The Iranian people are some of the most pro-American people in the Middle East. I say this not just because I've talked to a lot of them, but because of opinion polls. You know, to me, when I look at Iran, I look at a country like South Africa. South Africa under apartheid, the vast majority of South Africans opposed apartheid. But the people that supported it were in charge, and they were a minority, and they were a significant minority, but definitely a small minority. And they were in charge, and South Africa was a rogue and dangerous nation. But that didn't mean the majority of South Africans were that way. We have to make a distinction. The Iranian people, remember, the supreme leader, Khamenei, basically said there were 100 and 200 candidates tried to run, and he disqualified 194 of them, and he only allowed six candidates, the most extreme, the most conservative, to run. And the Iranian people could choose among those six, but the Iranian people chose the most moderate of the six hardline conservatives. So I want to be very, very clear here. I think the Iranian people long for a deal. I think they hate sanctions. I think the sanctions have harmed the Iranian economy. I'm glad of that. I supported the sanctions. I think the sanctions are the only reason why Iran came to the table. And I think the Iranian people very much want peace and don't give a fig about Iran's nuclear program. So I want to make a very clear distinction between the Iranian government and the Iranian people. That being said, the Iranian government is supporting mayhem all over the globe. They are responsible for the murder of hundreds of thousands of people in Syria, because without their support, I don't think the Syrian government could do what they could do. They tried to kill the Saudi Arabian ambassador in the United States. They are bombing Jewish houses of worship all over the globe. They are supporting Hezbollah and Hamas. These are not good people. The government is not good people, and I don't want to allied over the fact this is still a very, very dangerous regime.
And that being said, I wouldn't want us to be responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of innocent Iranians. Likewise, I don't think that would solve the problem. But let me throw this in. Here's the really unfortunate part, and this is what's so screwed up about our the domestic end of it. This is something that's really good. Any time in the world, I'm a person who believes in peace. Any move towards peace, hey, I'm all for it. Great. You know, we can argue, we can talk about who we do or don't trust. But I think all of us, universally, the three of us are all people who say, hey, you know what, we're all for
peace is good.
Regardless of the administrative issues, we are all for any kind of negotiations that will move in the direction of peace instead of war. The problem is this. Domestically, the Republicans have to unanimously oppose this. And they have to say it's horrible, it's terrible, it's the worst deal ever, simply because the Obama administration worked it. That's what's really screwed up. Barack Obama can walk up to a homeless person who's dying of starvation and hand them a sandwich, and they've got to say, well, that's a bad thing, you shouldn't have gave him that sandwich. That's what's screwed up and dysfunctional about this.
It's not just the Republicans. The leader of Israel has already condemned it.
Right.
That's
as has Saudi Arabia.
Yep. Yeah. And then the Republicans and the Israeli leadership will be saying, well, see, the Obama administration doesn't support us. But you know what?
I like that. Let me tell you why. This may sound crazy to you. I like it because I think that this is all about the next 6 months. And I believe in good cop, bad cop. I believe in the strategy. Many people know what good cop, bad cop is. Colin, you were a cop. You got the one friendly police officer, who talks to the perpetrator and tries to calm him down. And then you have the other tough guy that says, you know, hey, if you don't talk to this guy nicely, we're going to get you. Carrot and stick. I think actually that both Israel, Saudi Arabia and Congress that's saying if they don't do what they're supposed to do in 6 months, we're going to pass more sanctions. That encourages Iran, because the deal isn't over yet. This is just an interim deal, to act fairly within the next 6 months. So I support Obama's deal. I think it's a good deal for the next 6 months. But I also support the people that say if Iran doesn't comply and get rid of its nuclear program, then something more dangerous is going to happen in 6 months. I like that yin-yang of it.
And you can't push anybody into a corner. You push somebody into a corner and you know what the hell.
Well, I agree. Right. I agree. That's why I think we had to let Iran save face, and I think we did.
Yeah, I mean, we have destroyed 60% of their economy. You know, you can blame it on them if you want, but we have, in fact, destroyed.
Well, the world, the sanctions were approved by the Security Council. It wasn't just the United States.
Yeah, some of them were, not all of them. But, you know, that's an enormous thing. And if this deal had not come through, you would not see the Iranian people anymore liking the United States of America, because they know darn well who's pushing for the sanctions. You know, so this gives us a chance, and Iran a chance to do something good. If Iran can start getting its oil out there and making some profit on its oil again, then it just betters the situation for the people of Iran.
Well, that's not happening. Assets that we're going to provide for them. The oil sanctions, that's a worldwide, that's a Security Council sanction, and that's not being lifted until we see what happens for the next 6 months.
Right.
Again, I like that. I think the sanctions are the reason they came to the table, and I guess I wonder if you two gentlemen, Barack Obama, when he ran for office back in 2008 and reaffirmed in 2012, said that he believed that it was his principle that Iran would not get nuclear weapons. And I think that what he's doing now is working to make sure that's not the case. I'm not sure the two of you agree with the president on what he ran for office on. I mean, maybe you don't.
Well, let me say this. I think to some extent there are a number of players within this game who are saying things that they have to say for domestic consumption and to maintain their support within the group that they need.
Certainly, Prime Minister Netanyahu falls in that category.
Yeah, both, and so that's why, you know, while I'm no fan of Netanyahu because he's more of a, he's a right winger when it comes to foreign policy, I recognize that even if Netanyahu thought this was the greatest deal in the world,
he'd have to say that.
He had to say that.
Right.
It'd be ridiculous. You wouldn't understand anything about politics if you don't recognize that.
That's right.
So I'm not as so quick to condemn him, even though, you know, we've had our disagreements, in the past. So I understand that. And I don't believe that President Obama had the intention, the plan, or really felt attacking Israel was an option.
And attacking Iran.
Attacking Iran.
But attacking Iran was not. But I think he had.
Watch out for that slip of the tongue there, Garland.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You might get us all in trouble.
I think he needed to say what he had to say in order to be able to actively pursue a peaceful deal. So, that's my opinion.
Yeah, and the good thing about it is the IEA. What the heck is it?
The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. Thank you.
Yeah, is going to be involved.
Yes.
They're going to be watching. So, I mean,
a credible watchdog.
Yeah, and in one sense, I mean, Obama has achieved what he said. Iran is not going to have nuclear weapons. And
see,
this is the way it has to be achieved.
I don't know where we're going to go in the next 6 months, but I believe that this agreement is our best chance to get there. If it fails, and it may very well fail in 6 months, I have to say that it reminds me again. Y'all hate my metaphor, but I'm gonna go back to the way we should have done the filibuster. To me, if it fails, it shows the whole world we gave Iran every chance to be peaceful, and they failed. If it succeeds, it will be even better. That would be great. Be great for Israel. Be great for Saudi Arabia. One of the most fascinating things is that Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey were definitely not getting along, but they all three so strongly agree on Iran not getting nuclear weapons that they're patching up their differences among each other, which I think is kind of an interesting reaction to this. I think there's a chance this can succeed. One thing I want to compare it to, because I remember when this happened, is Bill Clinton's deal on nuclear weapons with North Korea. We did manage throughout the 1990s to stop North Korea from getting nuclear weapons through a very similar deal. We had people, we had IAEA there, we had inspectors there, they were watching, and North Korea did not develop nuclear weapons in the 90s. Then what happened, and I remember very clearly because I was working in Washington when this happened, George Bush invaded Iraq, he took his eye off North Korea kicked the inspectors out, and lo and behold, 2 years later, they're a very dangerous nuclear power. I think the answer is that this, we have to keep watching. And that this deal is good, just like I think Clinton's deal with North Korea was good. But if we ever take our eyes off this, something very dangerous could happen. And what's your comment?
Well, let me say this. I think something that Terry constantly says, and I think that supports it. Terry always says, you don't back people into a corner or you're more likely to get what you don't want. The fact that we started calling North Korea the axis of evil and we became more aggressive, I think, push them in the direction of saying, hey, you know what, we need nuclear weapons to protect ourselves, whether they were going to do it before or not. And I believe the same with Iran. I believe that the more you threaten to bomb Iran, the more you threaten them, the greater the probability is whether or not they are going trying to get nuclear weapons. But I think you increase the probability or increase the sense of urgency for them to get them, whether they are or not, I don't know. But so that's why I think that blustery, aggressive foreign policy is counterproductive.
It's always counterproductive. I mean, maybe some of it needs to be done just because I don't even know if it needs to be done.
I think you need carrot and stick, good cop and bad cop. I don't think either one alone I don't think good cop alone succeeds. I'm sorry. Then people take us for fools and they just do things behind our back. I agree that bad cop alone doesn't succeed. If you don't let people save face, they're backed into a corner. But I think you need both. What's wrong with both carrot and stick?
There's nothing wrong with both carrot and stick, but we've got to look at Iran as the country that it is. You talk about the Iranian people. The Iranian people are a proud people.
Absolutely.
The Iranian civilization goes back way before the United States was even thought about.
Right. Persian civilization is actually older than Arab civilization.
Yeah. And, you know, they have made a rational step with this election of their new president. And that is significant. And the leaders have allowed that to happen. Now, that may not be the way we'd like it to happen, but they have allowed it to happen. They have allowed this change. They have allowed the negotiations to go on. And we've got to give them some credit. Either if we do it in the back room, okay, do it in the back room. But even publicly, we should say, look, this shows that there are some in Iran that have integrity and have the best interest of the world at heart.
It's also important, by the way, to remember that the Iranian people rose up against their government in the Green Revolution that got far too little attention. In 2009, 2010, you had hundreds of thousands of people saying they wanted democracy in Iran. Again, I think the Persian people very much want democracy. They are the vast majority. They'd be like the blacks of South Africa in my apartheid example. But again, that doesn't mean that the government is to be trusted. You know, we need to verify. I hate to quote Ronald Reagan on anything, but I do think he was right about trust and verify. I think the deal is a good one, but we need to get the inspectors in. And we should make an implicit clear. If they kick the inspectors out, if they violate the deal, yeah, they're going to get a military option. I think sometimes when you threaten military, you never have to use it. Because you say very clearly, you signed the deal, Iran. You agreed to this one. This isn't something where, you know, you have your name on the dotted line. Now you keep this agreement. If they were to suddenly kick out the inspectors and ramping up the centrifuges, I think Obama would have no choice. I certainly hope that doesn't happen. And I don't even think it will happen, but we've got to, I think, make clear that if it does happen, there'll be consequences so that it never happens.
I disagree with that, and I'll tell you why. Let's say Terry owed me $50, right? And I said, and Terry wasn't paying, or actually owes Mark $1, if I'm not mistaken, for health care coverage or something.
That's yet to be seen on that one.
And so Terry finally says, Garland, I'm going to give you $5 a month for the next, you know, whatever, until I paid you that, and $10 extra. Now, I don't think it would be good for me to say, you know, Terry, I appreciate that. You gave me the $5. That's a wonderful thing. Now, if you don't, I'm going to beat you over the head with a baseball bat.
Bad metaphor.
No, I don't.
Bad metaphor. Owing someone $50 and having the power to have a nuclear armed terrorist state. I'm sorry. It ain't a good metaphor, Garland.
I just don't think you threaten along with, you know, that you have to do that. Because if you ask me, I know I'm talking too long, but if you ask me, I think that the interior revolution within the domestic issues within Iran forced their hand more so than the exterior, the foreign issues, because I think they're looking at how the people are suffering under the crippling sanctions. They know their people are unhappy, and they know that if they don't do something, that it's probably going to get worse. That's what I think pushed them.
I agree, but that's the sanctions. That's external. External pushed the internal, which pushed the government. So it's both. But go ahead, Terry.
There's one other really significant part about it, and it should be this is a song that should be sung a lot, because I mean Obama will get attacked. We know that the Republicans will go berserk and say sell out, and you know. Compare it to Chamberlain and
Neville Chamberlain. Yeah.
Nonsense. But at any rate, you've got this time. You've got the British, the German, the
yep.
Chinese,
the French, Russians, and the Russians.
The French and the United States coming themselves into an agreement. That is really significant, particularly with the tension that's been between Russia and the United States, and the tension with the economic thing between Britain and the EU, etc. These six countries sat down together.
In fact, the scuttlebutt is that France made it stronger. I don't know how much of this is true, but that France actually is one of the reasons we have a stronger deal, because they weren't going to stop their plutonium plant. So good for France for getting a better deal. Before we close up, I got a caller on the line. I suspect it's Michael from the Bronx. How are you, Michael?
Hey, you suspect correctly.
We call him Old Faithful because he's very faithful listening to our show and calling in practically every week.
Mark, I think we have to make him an unofficial member of the Raucous Caucus.
I think so. Congratulations, Michael. You are unofficially raucous. as usual. So I don't know, Michael, before the show, I mean, you can talk about the filibuster, you can talk about Iran, or Michael before the show called me up and said, could he say a little thing about George Zimmerman? And I said, sure. So is that what you want to talk about, Michael?
A little bit of Zimmerman and the filibuster.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, first off, with the filibuster, you know, you kind of had to admit you saw it coming, because these Republicans want to keep filibustering and blocking for no valid reason. They never, ever have any alternate new plans to help benefit this nation. I mean, this nation went into a sinkhole because of the predecessor of Bush and the right-wing policy.
That's a solid point that just real quick needs to be reiterated, and that is that it's one thing to have two different visions for the country and to battle with those visions, but the Republicans don't have an alternative vision. Their vision is stop Obama. And there's a difference between someone trying to start a car and someone trying to, you know, put the car in reverse, and people having two legitimate differences of opinion about directions where to go. I think if the Republicans had a positive agenda, rather than simply stop the government, stop Obama, they'd get a lot more sympathy for their policies.
And I think we should go ahead and get a metaphor class going.
We got a lot of them tonight. Today we had a lot of metaphors.
Metaphors going today, guys.
We're full of metal floors, that's for sure.
I was about to say they're metal floors with the Raucous Caucus.
All right, so now go ahead. We know you want to hand it to George Zimmerman. Go ahead, Mike. Yeah, make our day.
Yeah, but gentlemen, to understand this, that instead of the Republicans taking their defeat and take it as a lesson to be learned, they wanted to keep just railroading this entire nation and punishing everyone for voting in an African-American into the White House that has a much better vision to get this nation back on track. And that is why enough is enough. No one should have to be suffering. No one should have to be dying. No one should have to be going hungry or anything like that.
All true, but I do fear that one day this may turn around and hit us back, yeah, the filibuster.
Or the Republic.
Go ahead, tell us about our old friend, George Zimmerman.
You know something? I warned everybody when this acquittal came against Trayvon Martin that it was sending a wrong message to Zimmerman and to people like him, to those that want to glorify having guns in their possessions, and then they think they can go about bullying people with those guns and just shooting people.
Well, why don't we give the news? Because there are people who may not realize that George Zimmerman's in trouble with the law again. He threatened his wife, she left him, and now he threatened his girlfriend with a gun, and now he's in legal trouble, but I think he still hasn't been arrested yet.
He has.
Oh, he has finally been arrested? Okay.
He's been he's been arrested. This time they wasted no time in arresting him and arraigning him. Surprisingly, he's out on bail.
He's out on bail. That's right. He was arrested, but he's out on bail. That's okay.
He's been stripped of his weapons. But the thing is,
has he been stripped of his weapons? Because that suddenly made a lot of Floridians safer. People throughout the state are. I didn't realize he was stripped of his weapons. Okay, they finally did something in Florida. I'm glad to hear it.
Ironically, this is in the same county, the same city as with the Trayvon Martin case. And I would hope and think that the Justice Department, they're already monitoring Zimmerman and looking at pursuing federal civil rights charges in the Trayvon Martin case. But if Eric Holder happens to be listening, or the Justice Department, I reiterate to also look at the officials that handled that case, the prosecution, defense, even the judge and the police, because anybody that watched that case and followed the details, they would see that this was a railroaded case in an effort to get Zimmerman off and to deny the family, friends, and supporters of Trayvon Martin any kind of justice. And
there's one big flaw in that.
This is the flaw that's been forgotten.
Okay, hang on, Michael. Let's let Terry and Garland respond. Go ahead, Terry.
That's the flaw that's been forgotten. Whatever Zimmerman is, whatever happened, the part of the real crime here is the stand your ground laws.
Thank you.
And that's what empowered the the courts, et cetera. You know, if you want to use that word, and I'm not sure it's fair, empowered, but that's what allowed this acquittal to happen. And those laws have to be somehow either repealed or changed. Those laws are what are creating the danger, and they're spreading throughout other states. And nobody is talking about those laws, the stand your ground laws. Those are absurd.
They are absurd. Garland?
Well, and let me add something in there that a lot of people don't know. Look up this name, Frank Taft, T-A-A-F-E. He is George Zimmerman's spokesman. He is the guy who just gave the $9,000 to bail George Zimmerman out. He is a unapologetic white supremacist.
Really?
Absolutely unapologetic.
And he's the guy who bailed out Zimmerman. I didn't know about this.
Not only that, he's been on CNN. I tell you what, anyone who's listening, Frank Taft, T-A-A-F-E, Salon.com did a huge story on this guy where he does this podcast called The White Something or Other with some other guy. And I mean, the statements that he had, he's not beating around the bush. He's not saying I'm not a racist. He's using the N-word.
That's fascinating. Because all the people that said this wasn't a case about race, extremely few people, I thought I knew a lot about this case. I didn't know about this guy.
About race, because when you're going to turn around and then administer the stand your ground laws to a white person, I'm saying white person in terms of George Zimmerman, but then you had a black woman named Marissa Alexander, who's been a repeated domestic violence victim. She clearly had stand your ground on her side, and the same officials, same racist officials said, nope, it won't work here.
I'll tell you this, Michael, if you are Old Faithful, if you listen to enough of our shows, you'll see that Garland Nixon, to his credit, brought up the case of Marissa Alexander long before even the Trayvon Martin case came to the fore. Give Garland a lot of credit for bringing that to everyone's attention.
Keep in mind the centerpiece of all this, the Florida governor, Rick Scott, who has it in for every single minority woman, even every single progressive in that state.
Let me close then, because
criminally investigated.
Our time is up, Michael. I want to thank you very much for calling in. But this reminds everybody why it's so important in 2014 to get rid of a lot of these Republican governors in purple or blue states, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. These are all states that are rightly blue states, and yet they're controlled by Republican governors and Republican legislatures. And this is what the heart of 2014 should be all about, getting rid of Rick Scott and people like him.
I'm sorry, Mark. Correction. Controlled by sinisters and terrorists who need to be locked up.
I hear you, Michael. Thanks for your call.
And we haven't even celebrated that the Democratic Attorney General in your state, Virginia.
Yes. November 25th, that'll be tomorrow. They're going to certify that Herring won the election, but there will probably be a recount. So I'm not breaking open any champagne just yet.
Okay,
but he's ahead by 164 votes, I think it is, out of some 2.2 million cast. I think he's going to pull it out, but again, I just don't want to pop up on the champagne just yet.
It's nice to know that there's 116 people in
164
still thinking.
Yes, 164 plus the other 2 million or so.
Yeah, right.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's been a spirited discussion as always. Garland, where can they find you?
They can find me at Garland Nixon on Twitter or garlandn@gmail.com email or Garland Nixon on Facebook.
And Terry, where can they find you?
Oh, I'll keep it simple. Doctor of Democracy, DR of Democracy, AOL.com.
You can find me by following me on Twitter at Mark Living Talk. The website's marklivingtalk.com, where you can find every single past show, Raucous Caucus show, on just about any topic you can imagine. Check it out. I'm also facebook.com/marklivingtalk. Coming up next is the Inside Scoop. I'm going to give you the full history of the filibuster and definitely talk about Obamacare and things like that. Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Garland. Now, next week, we're going to have to talk. I don't know if we're going to be on air or not, given that it's Thanksgiving, but if not, you'll probably hear this show again. Who knows? Maybe we'll do a new show. Probably
yeah,
not.
And happy Thanksgiving to you and everybody.
But yes, happy Thanksgiving to both of you and to all of America, actually. Thanks again. If we're not back next week, we'll definitely be back in 2 weeks, every Sunday at noon. It's the Raucous Caucus. And right now comes up the Inside Scoop. Thanks.